Okay. I'm Jenny Kane, and I'm here in Hudson, and it is Wednesday, the 18th of July, and I'm here with Cornelius
Hageman.
Hageman.
Like Hageman Avenue in Brooklyn.
Hageman Avenue, okay.
My family had a farm there.
And where is this for? At the town, the Hudson Town Oral History Archive. So can you just say your name and...
Cornelius Hageman. I live in Germantown, New York.
Okay, and if you could just tell me a little bit, before we get into, the interview is sort of about the farm, but if you could, just before we get into that, I'd love to know a little bit about where you come from and...
Well, I'm retired from New York State Department of Corrections. I have a small farm in Claremont. I'm generally involved locally, local Masonic Lodge, doing charity work. We do, 15, 16 charity dinners a year, plus local food bank, plus whatever else needs to be taken care of in the village of Tivoli and Claremont. We just keep ourselves busy. It's something to do. You know, raise sheep, cattle, turkeys, chickens, cattle. You know, my crops generally fail. I mean, my water has a nice sulfur and salt content, so it generally kills most anything that grows, so raise animals.
Can you tell me about where you grew up?
I went to school South Colony outside Albany, but I generally lived and spent my weekends and summers in central Vermont. As a teenager, I worked for the Boy Scouts in Vermont all summer and most weekends, so that basically I got to the Albany area to go to school and, you know, worked in a small grocery store. And I got through high school by hook or by crook, but I went to Syracuse University out of high school, and then I went to Hudson Valley Community College and then SUNY Oswego, and I started with the state, and I went back and graduated from SUNY Oswego, and that's retired from the state. I worked a long career in corrections. It's nice to be out of.
Your family had a farm in Brooklyn?
Well, up till 1705, or not 1705, 1805. No, wait a minute, 1705. That branch of the family left Brooklyn. I don't know how much longer the farm stayed in Brooklyn, but they kept the Dutch church records for Flatbush, Rockaway, and Brooklyn Heights, which were the three Dutch parishes for the Dutch Reformed Church. They kept them in Dutch. I found the records in the New York Public Library. You know, the history. My family came up here. Up here and further up the Hudson Valley into mostly Saratoga County, and there were, you know, family has its ups and downs, you know. One time they were very wealthy, and then they were broke, and then they're wealthy, and then they're broke. It's just American story. But it's, my parents lived off outside the Saratoga battlefield. I mean, you know, we have family diaries that go that far back that show who was where and did what, and you know, it's like I have a set of china that was purchased at the when Burgoyne surrendered. He actually surrendered in what's now Schuylerville or Old Saratoga, and what they did is they auctioned off the baggage train from the surrendering army, and one of the things my family bought was a service for 16 tea set. You know, thistle pattern, which is Burgoyne's family crest. And the silver service is over in the Clark, over in Williamstown. It's the exact same pattern as the service for 16 that I have, you know, that's mentioned in the diaries circa 1820, 1825. So it's old. It's, family's been, you know, it's an American story. I mean, they did well, didn't do so well, and, you know, it's, my father died when I was young, my mother was a nuclear technician, and, you know, it's, what else can I tell you?
Siblings?
I have two older brothers. One is dead. One died, and he died about 10 years ago. He was 14 years older than I am. And I have another one down in Atlanta that's 2 years older than I am.
How did you come to be in Hudson, or this area?
Well, I had been living in Dutchess County and working where I did in corrections. To put it bluntly, I wanted out of Dutchess County for several reasons. One was the political situation, because 1991, I testified at an assembly hearing where the DA absolutely refused to prosecute inmates in the state prison system for officers that didn't live and work in Dutchess County. And I watched those people walk away on murders. And politically connected people get away with anything in Dutchess County. And I said, if something happens to somebody in my family, at least if I'm not in Dutchess County, I might be able to get an investigation. And the other thing is taxes. Columbia County is much cheaper in taxes than Dutchess County or points further south. You're also out from under the MTA tax. We have a board of supervisors here rather than a county legislature, so that you basically subtract one entire layer of government. It's much more efficient. It's a much smaller county. It's exceedingly well run compared to what I was used to in Dutchess County. And I've lived over most of New York State, and I looked at Columbia County and I said, you know, it's a nice place to live. You know, Hudson was just starting to turn around in those days. It's about a little over 20 years ago now, and you know, Hudson was a place you really didn't want to go to. It's not like it is now. I mean, you come here now, it's beautiful, and it's safe, it's reasonable. You know, there's still some of the vestiges of the old culture, but now there's entrepreneurship. There's young people that are trying and doing new things, and they have ideas, and they're working on things, and they're doing it. Half of them don't tell the city or the government what they're doing, and it works out better that way. It's just they're doing things. It's revitalizing an area. A lot of the people coming in from the city have made a huge difference. A lot of the antique dealers. There's a thriving, how do you say, better way to put it, is a gay community, and they've done wonders for this area. I mean, their work ethic and what they wanted to build here, and I know they did it as individuals. They didn't do it as a group or a migration. They just came in and said, well, this place culturally is friendly, generally friendly to us. They're not hostile. And it allowed for growth. It allowed for entrepreneurship. It allowed for different ideas. They weren't automatically written off. And it's a good way to be. When you look at what happens elsewhere, it's just, there was a lot of good that could happen here and a lot that did. A lot of the factories, a lot of things that were here, they closed down, and Hudson was dying. You could buy almost any house in this city for $20,000, $25,000. Within 10 years, they're worth 10 times that or more. It's just a radical change in culture, a radical change in outlook and what people were doing, and people who wanted to adapt to it did very, very well. People got into construction and rehabilitation of houses. They've been employed, and if they're good at it, they were never unemployed. So that there's a lot to be said for this area. And for me, I looked at it and said, taxes, relatively honest government, you know, it was a nice change. It wasn't what I was used to.
Did you bring your family up here then?
Well, my wife, my kids were on their own by that time, were living with their father, they're my wife's kids. And my wife and I came up, we bought a house in Claremont, which is, you know, it's Germantown post office, but it's town of Claremont. The joke is, in Claremont, we have nothing and we like it that way. We don't even have a blinking light, and we mean that a couple of ways. But what people don't realize is there's three music studios in Claremont. Nobody even knows they're there. They do hip-hop and rap, you know, but they don't bother anybody, and most people don't even know they're there. You know, there's a big convent there. There's you know, big old horse farm that, you know, its heyday's long gone, but it's we don't have a lot of overhead. We have a lot of common sense in what we do and why we do it. Like the state came through and wanted to build us an $8 million firehouse. Our fire commissioner said no. And the reason being is said, if we build an $8 million firehouse, yes, you'll pay for it, but then we have to pay to maintain it. That would double our fire taxes for a structure that in our town we don't need. So that they said, they recommended no, but yet when it came for pensions for the volunteer firemen, it was an overwhelming vote yes, because these people do serve our community. See, we're not against spending money where there's a reason and a value, but you have to realize, how big's our town? You know, what are we, you know, we have villages and towns around us. You know, if you go to a town like Red Hook, it's 3% zoned commercial. Commercial property is a license to steal. In Claremont, 20% is zoned commercial in some way, shape, or form. So that if you want to open a business, if you want to work out of your home, you want to do something, in Claremont it's allowed. Many of the other houses or many of the other towns in the area, the zoning absolutely precludes it. Columbia County is far better when it comes to entrepreneurship and opening. They want to work with you. They want to see people employed. They want to, and there's always a few naysayers, but for the most part, if you're willing to run a business and not harm your neighbors and do things in a reasonable way, and you know, the local people support you. And if you work hard, they'll go, wow, must be nice people. They work hard. There's the old Puritan work ethic, in a sense, that if you see people and they're out there working hard, you give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, you don't. And it's not always that way in small towns.
When you arrived here in this area, you had already retired by then?
No, I worked another 10 years after I came to the area. I wanted out of Dutchess County. I mean, I wanted to own a house, and I wanted to own some property, and I ended up buying 22 acres, and that way I could bring my horses home. I'd had horses, and I didn't always ride horses, but from the first week on the job, they trained me for horse patrol, and, you know, I never had the bid steady, but, you know, 15, 20 times a year, I'd have to go into work at 10:30 at night, and saddle up my horse and ride till 6:30 in the morning. And it was just, that's what you did. If you saw anybody, stop them. But, you know, in the middle of winter, it's a pain, or in freezing rain, it's really annoying. But for the most part, it's like, it's boring. You go out 10:30 at night and ride a horse till morning. It's just, you're a little sore, have trouble walking when you get off the horse in the morning. But, you know, usually you don't ride for 8 hours. You walk a ways and, you know, feed the horse. And
where were you riding?
At the prison in Fishkill, the old Mattawan State Hospital for the criminally insane, Fishkill Correctional. A horse is cheaper than a car. Horse costs $2,500 a year to run. A vehicle costs $3,500, $4,000. So if you're going to put people out there, in rough terrain, a horse can go anywhere. A horse can, if somebody's out there, a horse is going to look at them and tell you somebody's out there, so you don't get ambushed, because you're out in wide open country on 500-600, about a square mile of grounds. And if somebody's out there, and usually what happens is the firemen from Beacon come up and jack deer. You know, they'll come up and shoot a deer and then leave the rifle and take off, and 3 hours later come back and get the rifle. And because you're in the middle of the city, you're on the edge of the city of Beacon, and everybody hears it, and they don't want to get caught with a rifle coming off the prison grounds. So they'll come back 2 or 3 in the morning and try to drag out their deer. And, you know, this local volunteer firemen, they just, you know, they think they're getting away with something. And that's your biggest fear, is getting shot by one of them. But, you know, for the most part, it's a very boring job. But you do need somebody out there. If there's a car accident or something happens, you need somebody. You know, you need at least one person out there, so. It was a nice, you know, it was a nice break from working inside the prison. sort of like a reward. Freezing rain, go out and ride the horse. Great. This was, and you know, there's several places that use horses around the state still. And
I'm interested in how you got into corrections.
When I got out of college, I was 9 credits short of a degree. In the middle of a recession with 15 to 18% unemployment, far higher than it is now. There were no jobs. I took every civil service exam I could my senior year of college at the State College of Oswego. And when I got out, the only job I could get was as a field sports instructor teaching rifle and archery at a Jewish girls' camp. Kosher dining hall. It's a nice deal. I was the only one over 21, so I had to take the staff out every night when they get through work. You know, I was the only one they could license on the, you know, insure on the van. So I take the staff out, and, you know, you're out in the hills of Rensselaer County, a town in Nassau. You have to understand, the people out there, you go in, they're usually used to cutting wood. They're covered with sawdust, and, you know, they're rough characters. They have vocabularies in range of 400 or 500 words tops. They're simpler type people. Now you take, how do you put it bluntly, a bunch of nice-looking girls in mid-thigh-length skirts, 18, 19 years old, from New York City to, how do you say, Lions Lake, which was the name of the place, to a bar, and it makes for strange times, especially when it comes 11:45 and you have to tell the girls, girls, time to go. You know, the guys get a little annoyed at that, so it's... So that summer when they called me that they needed people in corrections and they took a physical and they said, we have an opening next Monday. And I said, I don't have enough money to go back to college and finish my degree. And it was, there were no other jobs that I could see anywhere around. And I hate to say it, what I didn't know is once you get into corrections, nobody else wants you. You know, it's just the nature of it. Most people become very authoritarian, the environment really sours people, and it does play on you. I mean, it's most people don't make it to retirement. They just don't. And if they do, they don't live very long. I've been out longer than most people. They have a life expectancy of 56 years, 9 months in that job. And on average, they collect 9 retirement checks. So a 25-year retirement really doesn't mean much to most of these guys because they're not going to live to enjoy it. It's just most of them don't. Most of them don't live to make it to retirement. The stress gets them, they'll have a heart attack, and it's going to kill them because it is a very stressful, stressful place. And it's...
You were also in the city, you mentioned.
Yes, it was when I got promoted. I was promoted to a women's prison called Bayview, 20th Street and 11th Avenue. And, you know, you have to understand the nature of where you are. I was living in Brooklyn Heights. I couldn't afford 2 residences. So the superintendent said, "You, to me and another sergeant, do you want to put a room in on the second floor for employees coming down from upstate? Because, and then he charges a state rate, which is like, $75 a month. Which is fine. Trouble is, it was right at the exhaust point for the cab repair shop next door. So you breathe in a lot of fumes. And the one way you don't get accused of anything is whenever you have a new employee, there's a Blue Oyster Bar across the street, like from the Police Academy movies. So every new employee I'd get, they'd have their day orientation, and I'd say, take them over there for a drink after work. And it shocks a lot of them. You got to understand, they're people like anybody else. You know, they look at me and go like, wow, you're different. Well, yeah, I am. So are you. So have a drink. You know, I'm not going to get cause trouble with them. I'm not going to, you know, it's just, It's a bar. They serve alcohol, and yeah, it's different than anything I would ever see up here. It's just people are people, but it's and everybody's nervous at first, but once they talk to you, get to know you, they say, okay, so you're not gay. Big deal. It's like so, but the girls, they see you go in there, and they assume you're gay, and it doesn't help that if you're, tested as a supervisor, you have to test the food. So you test the food. When the male officers walks by, you say to the girls, "Oh, isn't he so cute?" They get all disgusted, and they don't charge you anything. You get, because you have to understand what you're dealing with. Common sense and statistics are going to tell you that of the women you deal with in that prison, 63% are going to die from HIV-related complex over the course of their lifetime. Why would you do anything stupid? You're going to lose. Just roll the dice. You're going to lose. So the point is that it's not just that they're convicted felons. It's also that, guess what? You've been at this long enough, you know the behaviors, you know the manipulation, and you know it's a job. So what happens is you end up firing a lot of employees for doing stupid shit with the inmates because you can't fix stupid. You just can't. And you have to understand that it's a job and you go and do a job. Then once you understand that, it's relatively easy. Make it more than it is.
How was your transition sort of from that world to being back in a more rural area?
You gotta understand, I was a country boy. I worked for the Boy Scouts in the mountains. I used to take groups up and down the long trail. And there was a section 1 year where in the summer I didn't speak to another person for 6 weeks. And the first time I ran into somebody and tried to speak, I'd forgotten how. It took me 10 or 15 minutes to start getting words out again because you don't use it enough. You're like, and I know that's a visual thing, but you can't get it from your head out your mouth. And so being a country boy is natural to me. I mean, and the first thing I do is look around my property. And the interesting thing is, when I moved here, I had three neighbors who were growing marijuana. Not large scale, but enough to pay their taxes. They're poor people. They don't have it. So what you do is you put a set of blinders on and you ignore it. The reason being is you're working 60 miles away. You don't want your house burned down while you're at work. You don't want your wife having problems with people. So you ignore it. You just put a set of blinders on and you don't see anything. Well, the one guy 2 doors down from me started dealing coke and ecstasy, and the county sheriff's department came in with a SWAT team and busted him. But he used to walk down the state highway with a hoe over his arm and go over into the state park where he was growing his marijuana. I mean, he was a farmer. What are you gonna do? The others, one guy, I bought acreage behind me and plowed it up. Well, he didn't like it because then he could be easily tracked into fresh dirt when he's going over to plant his field of marijuana on a property to the north of me. So he started taking bolts off my tractor, which could get you hurt badly. So what I did is I cut open my fence, let my goats out, and they ate his marijuana crop. You don't call the police. So 6 o'clock in the morning, the guy knocks on my door and says, "Your goats are eating my shrubbery." And I said, "No, they're eating your marijuana crop because you were playing with my tractor. Next time I will call the police." And then he very blatantly asked me if he could buy goat's milk. You can't make this stuff up. The other one, he just disappeared. I don't know what happened to him. But it's like, so for 10 years, 15 years, there's been very little activity like that in the neighborhood. There had been an apple farm to the north of me, and the guy was old and the apple farm had gone, and he's since died off, and that property's been abandoned for 3 years. And then the deer farm, they wanted the property that I bought, so they were upset with me and didn't talk to me for a number of years because, well, the property had been for sale for 8 years when I bought it. But they're mad that I bought it. So it's a small town thing. And the other thing is, in a small town, many of the longtime residents, they don't talk to you for at least 18 to 20 years. When you move in, they just don't talk to you because you're a stranger. You're one of them. But getting involved in community activities like the cemetery in Tivoli. You know, the graves are 250 years old. They collapse. They can't afford to hire somebody to come in. So 15 or 20 of us get together, and I have some small tractors. I go in and fill in the graves. You know, and we rake them off and reseed them. We cut the branches down, haul them away. So the only thing they have to pay for is cutting the lawn. That way it stays under local control and doesn't turn into under state control. Rehabbing the Red Church. It's the icon of the village of Red Hook, or town of Red Hook. It's 250 years old. If you understand what they built, when they built the church, it was built with all the scrap they could gather from all the local farms, and whatever boards weren't being used on people's houses, they donated and built the church. So that no two sides of the building are square, no two sides of the building have the same size siding, and yet we have to build it, repair it exactly back to the original. Now, that gets expensive. But you work with local people, you know, caulking the windows or, you know, but they've been able to get some state grants. And with the lodge, we raised about $75,000 towards it. And then with the matching grants, they're almost finished with what they're going to do on it. Then there's things like, let's say you got a 90-year-old lady who's been in the community forever and, you know, she breaks her hip. She needs handicapped access to her house. Well, she doesn't have any money to do that, so the lodge, we have contractors and one thing and another, and we have extra money. We'll go in and put in handicapped ramp, handicapped door, handicapped access to the bathroom, handicapped, and don't charge her. Just do it. And, you know, this is how you turn an area into a community. It's like when I was master of the lodge, the Legion Post in Germantown. They'd fallen on really hard times. The roof went, the boiler went, they needed handicapped access. And they had to abandon their building. And their fundraisers were all falling flat. Of course, the guy they had cooking was cooking beef to 165 degrees, and it came out like shoe leather. But they were having problems in the local community. Now, these people had helped with every fire. They had sponsored the Boy Scout troop. They had helped with every little thing that goes on in that town for 60 years. And you don't want to see them fail. So down in Tivoli, we held a fundraiser for them. We held a big dinner, and we raised them $2,500, but because we did that and it got out, they received a little over $12,000 in donations. So they were able to rehab their building, get things, and then I went up and I cooked a couple of meals for them. You know, roast beef. And when you have 80-year-old guys sitting there with a plastic spork cutting roast beef, and they say, "This is the best roast beef I've ever had," all you can say to them is, "Sorry. You had to wait till you're 80 to get properly cooked meat." It's comical, but it's, if you have certain skills, you use them. And it's like cooking chicken. I mean, nobody takes 3 hours to properly cook barbecue chicken without burning it or blackening it. Well, I do. It's a skill, and you season it without salt. So it's juicy and tender, and you can twist the bone right out of the leg. And, you know, it's these are things that, you know, you can add to a community because not everybody has those skills. And I bought trailer cookers that I can hook onto my truck and go and cook wherever. And you end up meeting people that way. And in a community, that's what you do.
Is that kind of how you first encountered the Germantown Community Farm?
How I first encountered them is Kaya called me up out of the blue, and I had never met her. She had heard I had a trailer, and she didn't know me, but somebody recommended me and given her my number. She called me and asked me to trailer a tractor from Chatham back to the farm so they could plow a field that they had bulldozed off. And it was the first one they really plowed the field, because they had been farming up and trying to farm an old, lack of a better word, a 1960s hippie commune called the Bob up in Pine Plains. And they had been working as waitresses and different jobs that when they came to this area, they took any job they could get. They had nothing. And when I met them, they asked me to do this, and they insisted on paying me because I took one look at them and said, "You don't have running water." I mean, and I knew. You know, you smell. They don't have running water here. You know, they don't have proper septic here. And they were basically camping out trying to rehab this farm. And you knew they had less than nothing, but you look at their work ethic and what they were trying to do, and you know, you just sort of like, part of me felt sorry for them. I mean, at that time, part of me did. Because something had happened about a year and a half prior to that in the town. There was a girl, she had some depression issues, and she had started a restaurant in Germantown, across from Otto's Market, and the restaurant failed. And what a lot of it happens in a small town is neglect. People say, oh, 25-year-old girl starting a restaurant like this, and everybody just avoided it. Well, of course it's going to fail. Well, but with the depression issues, what happened is the girl hung herself in the restaurant. You looked at this and said, this ain't right. It just... And you got to understand the small town method. Nobody did business with her because it was there was a small town attitude that, you know, nobody knew her. And she started the wrong time of year because 30% of the community is weekend people from the city or Philadelphia. So the money to go to a restaurant wasn't there. You know, it was set up to fail from the day it started, and she had no idea. But she had worked so hard, put everything she had into it. And you look at this and go, so somebody walking by sees her hanging in there. You know, and you see this. And then you look at these three girls starting a farm. Now, Dylan, Kai's brother, had sort of gotten them into this and made the deal with Asa. But you look at how hard they were trying. And, you know, you really didn't want to see them fail. You know, you looked at them and you said, You got to help them in some way. You got to, even if it's just cheerleading, you know, and it's, and, you know, coming out of corrections at that time, I must have seemed pretty weird to them, too, because, you know, I'm looking at them as, okay, they're utopian. They want to build a better world. Whether I agree or disagree with their utopian world is irrelevant. They're entitled to it, and they're trying to live by it, and that commands respect to me. You know, you have to have that level of respect for that because they want to make something better. They're looking at what is and said, I think they think we have, they thought they had a better way. And in a way, I think they do. I got to, coming around to their point of view on a lot of things. But once they plowed the field and I hauled the tractor back for them, because I guess it was Kaya and Ashley that went, and they'd gotten... They did everything by hand, and I was like, you can't do this. But they had, at one point for the house garden, they had 50 people come up from the city, and they dug the garden by hand, a quarter acre. A lot of them didn't even have tools. They're using their fingers to pull the grass out of the ground and turn the ground. I was like, oh, boy. And I said, Kaya, I can do that with 10 minutes with my tiller. Well, they're all coming, and I have to have something for them to do to make them feel part of it. And I thought about that, and I said, in a way, that's brilliant. Because she did have to have something for them to do, or they wouldn't feel part of it. They felt that they would have felt they'd made this entire trip for nothing. So no matter what it was, you had to have something for these people to do. And there's a wisdom there that, you know, you don't see too often. And the truth is, the first one that really impressed me and has always impressed me is Kaya. Because... Is she well educated? Not particularly. Is she widely experienced? Now she's getting that way. But what you can't deny is that after 5 minutes, if you're really watching, you got to realize she is the smartest person in the room. People, you know, you look at a 23-year-old kid, nobody wants to admit that she's the smartest person in the room. But she was. She didn't lord it over people. She didn't let you know it, but if you paid attention, she would ask you questions. She'd be guiding what you were thinking. And she'd be three steps ahead of you. And, you know, we talk about it from time to time. And, you know, I tell her it's a blessing, and she still thinks it's a curse. Because, you know, you get frustrated when people can't keep up. And I hate to tell her, I understand, but she's smart. But as hard as they worked, and what they did know from working on various farms, and what they did know, like, it's obvious they'd been growing gardens. It's obvious that some of them had been working on farms before. But they didn't know basic soils. They didn't know basic insects. They didn't know the basic science that you need to know of farming. Now, yeah, they want to be basically an organic farm. Okay, I can respect that. But they don't understand why. They don't understand, you know, in order to be against modern farming and ag chemicals, you should know what it is and why you're against it. Because if you erase that, which third of the planet do you stop feeding? And that's a reality, because you cut food production in this country by, or in the world, by roughly a third without the ag chemicals. Now, the point being is that you can use a lot less, and you can use better method and better methodology. But they were working with some clay soils, with some gravel. They didn't understand the difference between a sandy loam and a clay soil. They thought you could farm the same in both. And they did use raised beds there. They had a very wet year, but they got a tremendous yield because I gave them about 10 yards of composted sheep and goat manure. And the reason being is I knew while it would be weedy, and they'd have a lot of problems with weeds, it would fertilize the ground for 3 years without anybody doing anything to it. And it would do that well in the clay soil. But they had no idea why I gave them what I gave them. All they knew was they needed a fertilizer. They couldn't afford to go buy organic fertilizer. And my fertilizer and compost was... They knew I didn't use ag chemicals. They knew I didn't use these things. And they loaded it by, you know, loaded it with onto their pickup truck, and they kept on load after load after load. Normally, I sell that stuff. I mean, I normally sell $30, $40 a load. Well, I just gave it to them because I knew they needed it. But their crop yields were, per square foot, probably the best yields they've had before or since. But what happened is, you know, fall came. Ashley went to out to Cornell as a visiting student for a year, till that following May. Courtney, I'm not sure where Courtney went that year, but I know she was away all winter, which left Kaya in the house with a guy named Sasha. Now, Sasha was paying rent, but it wasn't part of the farm, and he had been there when the Bard students were there and destroyed the whole place. And Sasha, he's a really nice guy, but he was seriously schizophrenic. And when he got off his meds, he had to be hospitalized. He wasn't violent, but he was more suicidal. But Kaya could deal with him, and most people couldn't have. But it was like Kaya was there by herself, so every few days I'd stop by, you know, or I'd deliver a truckload of firewood, or, you know, because I'd have trees cut down and I don't burn firewood. But I would stop by and just talk. And it's more just to, you know, I'd hired Kaya and Ashley because they had had, I'd hired Ashley and Courtney to work at my place, and another one that was there. I don't remember who that was. But they had a business, side businesses. They were getting the farming going, putting in, taking care of gardens for a lot of the summer people. And they did a really nice job of it. They did a beautiful job of it. And I hired them to clean out my garage and help around, just clean up some things around the yard, because the truth is I'm pretty badly crippled at this point, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, I hired them because, one, I needed the work done, and two, they could use the money. And as they got more into the farming, they did less of the other. But they were still had oddball jobs off the farm to make enough money to make ends meet. And, you know, If I was a betting man, I would have bet it would have failed, because when winter comes and you need a pair of boots and your boots ripped 6 inches along the side and you can't afford to buy another one, most people give it up and try something else. Well, they got through it, and I sometimes I wonder how, but they got the roof on the barn the first year, and then they worked on a well another year, and they worked on the electrical in the house and the boiler in the house, chimney in the house. 1 year Kai redid all the windows in the house, because they do one project a year to upgrade the property, and then they finally got the septic so they could actually use the indoor plumbing, instead of having to use the outhouse. I mean, it's and I don't know if you've ever used outhouses in the wintertime, but where I'm from, it's rather common, but it's cold. There's no heat in an outhouse. And, it's 10 below zero, you gotta go. You still have to go out and you've gotta go. But that's the way they had to live. The water sometimes worked. Sometimes I guess it didn't. But all the fields in the farm, other than the one that they had initially bulldozed, were old, half-dead orchards. Because what happens is, if you don't use the antibiotic on the orchard, what happens is the fire blight comes up on the bees from Florida, and it's going to kill everything in the field anyway, because it forms like a the bacteria forms like a slime mold around the branches, and the branches die out from there, and it kills them all. That's why they have to spray. But there's that, and then there's Bordeaux mix to keep the fungus down, and those are the two that are absolutely needed to run any orchard in this valley. And they talk about organic orchards, I'll laugh at them, because they don't work. Because the problem is, if we had only local beekeepers, they would work. But when you ship bees from Florida all the way to Maine, they bring the tropical diseases with them. And it's just, this is what happens. But I started just bringing my tractor over and clearing fields for them. A little bit here, a little bit there. And you got to understand the learning curve. Like, they would take a chainsaw and cut all the dead trees off 4 inches above the ground. Now you say, well, gee, that's great. Except that what do you grab onto with the bucket to get the stump out? It's easier to get the stump out if you have the whole tree there and you push 6 feet up the tree, you have leverage, and you have also have the weight of the tree to help pull the stump out. But these are things they had never faced, had no idea how to do it, and they were out there trying to hack these things out with pick and shovel. And you look at them and say, this can't. So I just drove over with my tractor. And then I found out they didn't know anything about what's called the agricultural exemption, which reduces the taxes on your property by 90%. Now, this doesn't include the house. The house is separate. The house on 1 acre is separate, but if you put your land into agricultural purpose, and there's more finite rules for smaller acreage, but if you have more than 10 acres, you can, and you make more than $10,000 a year for the 2 previous years, you can get an agricultural exemption, and it drops your property tax by 90% on your land. Well, I had the agricultural exemption on my property, but they didn't have it on theirs because they hadn't made $10,000. But what I did is I covered their property under my agricultural exemption for 2 years until they could make enough money to get it on their own. That saves them, I don't know, $5,000 to $7,000 a year for those 2 years till they could get it on their own. And getting to do this was like pulling teeth. It was because they didn't understand. And they see this old guy coming, they assume ulterior motives, and they go, no, I'm married, that's it. I mean, but you see how hard they worked, and even their neighbors were starting to be won over by the how hard they're working. Because one neighbor was generally a crank, and everybody's a drug dealer, and everybody's this. Well, I knew her from the prison, and she would visit her husband there. He finally died, but she would visit him. He was doing 25 years. Nice guy. I mean, didn't he? He was a nice guy. I mean, but he was doing 25 years. And, you know, she loved him, and she stayed loyal to him. But she would go to the state police on anything, and it was like, but she'd see these girls working, and, you know, she lives right around the corner from the farm. And she'd say, "You see how hard those girls work? The guys that are there, they don't do nothing." I go, "The guys aren't working on the farm." But so she was, but then I told him about the kids, you know, and then she needed something done. So I asked a couple of the girls to go over and help her out, and she met the girls, and now she's their biggest fan. But it's a matter of when you come to a new community, it helps if you have somebody that'll speak for you with some of the other people who would tend to run their mouths and run you down, and then everybody shuns you in a small rural area. And that's how kids, that's how new things fail. It's how people give up and walk away. And that's what you don't want to have happen. So, you know, like people say, "Oh, I see you up there in a tractor. What are you doing up there? What are you doing with those hippies or this or that?" And I said, "You want to know about them? Go talk to them. They're hardworking. They do this. And then, you know, like they got some goats. And it's not a big thing, but, you know, what happens is the National Guard flies over high up and takes pictures looking for marijuana. And, you know, there's ways to plan it so it isn't seen from straight down where the pictures are. But what they did is they see tomato plants and they show up the same as marijuana. So now you get the state police helicopter 50 foot off the farm going over every square inch of that 55 acres because somebody's running their mouth. And of course they found nothing. You know, it's just not there. It's not the way these kids operate. And so I go and talk to Eli. You know, he's the town deputy for the sheriff's department. He covers three towns. He's the patrol sergeant, and he's a really good guy. He's the guy who, well, in the last 5 years, he's talked three jumpers off the bridge. Most people would push him off the bridge. He talks them off, and he's a good guy, and he's a real, and he lives there. He lives right around the corner from the girls that were there then. And I said, you know, go talk to these girls. If you want to search your property or take the sheriff's ATV around the property anytime, go ahead. But what you did is with that helicopter, you ran their goats into the fence and nearly got them killed. So, come on. Go down and give them a break. Or talk to this guy. He hunts the property all the time. See if he's ever found anything there. Because he gives the kids a bottle of wine and they let him hunt the property. But they were there a couple seasons. And then Ben and Lou came in somewhere. And, you know, and I know I don't have the timeline so well. But Luann, there were a couple. And Luann, was a metal worker, an artist. And her and Courtney didn't get along so well, I guess. But Courtney, Ashley, and Ben were working the farm. And they worked very, very well on the farm. They did. They got into the farmer's market, and the CSA got going well, and they were making money. But for me, Ben had a degree in philosophy from Brown. And, you know, he assumes he's smarter than you are, and he isn't. You know, he just isn't. I mean, it's like, is he educated? Absolutely he's educated. What does he know about farming? Not much, because when I retired, I knew I didn't know much about farming, so I went out to Cobleskill and audited a bunch of courses in agriculture, soils, ag chemicals, and how farms work and why and what their business models are. And, you know, and over the years, I've met all these kids' parents, you know, one time or another. And, you know, Ben's father was like, you know, he spent all this money going to Brown up there in New Hampshire, and now he's a dirt farmer. So I explained to him the business model of how CSA works, and people buy a share up front, and then the extra goes to the farmer's market, and they can turn a pretty good profit, and if you really want to work it the whole year with a winter CSA too, you can make $65,000, $70,000 a year in your pocket. Most of these kids work either one or the other, and they make, you know, in their pocket between $15,000 and $25,000, but they're actually working very hard, but it's not the whole year. and then they'll do other things. So that it's, but what they do is they have a very good business model. And with the CSA, it cuts down the risk because there's no crop insurance on vegetables. So like the hailstorm they just had a few weeks ago wiped them out. They didn't have a CSA to fall back on. They're lucky because they Nicholas and Eileen, I'll get to them, they've made good friends all over the area, and most of these places have extra trays of plantings that you don't put in because you plant six trays of plantings when you need four or five, so in case something happens. Well, something happened. They all bought and they replanted the farm, and they had a party. I cooked them chicken. I mean, they had, you know, people got through work at 4:30, and 30 people came, and they replanted the farm. And I mean, you get 30 people working, and they have the plants all ready to go, and, you know, Nicholas had tilled up the soil. But, you know, back to before the others left, Ashley had bought a tractor on her own, and that had difficulties with it. All the hydraulics that run through the transmission and run right through the center of the tractor, the pipes had worn out. It's a 40-year-old tractor. And she had to pay to have it fixed because you literally need a shop and have to tear the tractor in two to get at these hydraulic lines to fix them because they're internal. And a lot of things that they did, they bought tractors when a walk-behind hand-powered hand implement that I would know about in the Carolinas would have been cheaper and far more useful because this area doesn't have the infrastructure and the places to buy those small pieces of equipment that you would use on a vegetable farm. Well, in the Carolinas, they do. Here, they don't. Because in the last 10 years, 40 of these farms have opened up in Columbia County, and I've only seen one with that type of equipment. I mean, but I've traveled. I've seen what's in other areas. And a lot of these guys are using tractors that were used for haying or other types of equipment or plowing, and they're trying to cultivate with it. And it's very inefficient, and they're getting good results, but it's three times as difficult as it should be, what they're doing. There's nobody at Cooperative Extension that could explain to them how to do it, because nobody's done this type of farming in this state since they were doing it up in Colony 40 years ago. And those things, all as the suburbs came in, all those farms, the truck farms that trucked all the vegetables in New York City, went out. So that type of farming I saw as a kid. And I saw how they did these small plots and what they used and how they did it. And it was so much simpler than what they're doing here. And I'm not being critical, but you have to respect the work ethic because they're finding a way to do it. And most people would have given up. And they keep trying. Ben and Lou eventually left. Courtney left. She and Ashley had some disagreements. And, you know, friends do. Things change. People, and when you look at the personalities involved, I mean, like I talked a little bit about Kaya. You know, she's helped out with the radio station. She rehabbed that building over there. You know, got the internet company up and running there. Now she's trying to start an educational program. I mean, she's moving on and doing other things, but she's trying to also keep the farm in operation. You know, she's still on they have a committee that works to meet and discuss things and how it's going and who's going to work the farm and how it's going to be worked. And the farmers have the choice on that, and they make their own deals, and they have their house meetings, and they have their farm meetings, and it's a foreign world to me. It's a utopian world that I'm not used to, but I have to look at it and say, in a lot of ways, it's a better way. And, you know, what do I know? But I can respect it. And you want to help them. I mean, if for nothing else, just to cheerlead them. And then, like, at the time, my wife was very sick. The doctors had told her she had 2 years to live and go home and cough out and die. She had bronchiectasis. And she was having 8 pneumonias a year. Well, 3 years ago, we found a new doctor up in Albany who changed her meds and won pneumonia in 3 years. You know, it's like a whole new life. But every day you go home and you're wondering if your wife's going to be alive because it's like, you know, it's hard for me, but, you know, to go up and see the kids and help them out, dealing with their problems made mine look small. So, you know, I benefited from it too. You know, seeing what they were doing, I never tried to tell them what to do, but I would ask them a question that I know they didn't have the answer to. And then they'd ask me about the question. And I tried to get them to think about soils. I tried to get them to read soil maps. And I'd ask them, what does that mean? And they wouldn't know. And I said, well, you kind of need to know that so that you'd know the nutrition uptake of the plants. You know, about pH, what pH means for nitrogen uptake in a plant, phosphorus uptake, and nutrient uptake, and water uptake. You know, what pH does the plant thrive at? And what will kill it, and why? And then you ask, what pH is your soil? Oh, gee, I don't know. Well, this can kill you on a farm. So I'd ask those kind of questions. And when I met Kaya's father, I was like, you know, she's very educated in the politics of this, and I agree with her. And what she knows is sandy soils. Well, grew up in Cape Cod, you know, sandy soils. And, you know, because that's what she would have seen, and that's what she grew as a garden. But I go, this is clay. You know, this is something different. This works differently. And when they healed up down below, they got lucky. But what happened down below is Ben didn't want to get his feet wet. So we got, you know how you have a wood chipper goes down the road for the state and clears all the brush along the highway? He got a couple truckloads of that and put it in between all the hills so that he wouldn't get his feet wet when he's weeding the hills. That's fine. As long as you took a walk pine tiller and only tilled the tops of the hills. But what he did is he tilled all those wood chips into the whole field. The problem with that is those wood chips draw nitrogen out of the soil for 5 years. Now, is there nitrogen in the soil? Absolutely. Can the plants take it up? No. The only plant that can is either a blueberry or a ribes, a raspberry, you know, cranberry maybe. Some of the berries can. But other than that, any of your vegetable plants, pH is going to be wrong, and there's nothing you can do about it until that stuff rots away, and you've got to turn that field 3 or 4 times in 5 years before you can even use it without spending, argument's sake, 10 times what you would normally use for a fertilizer and 10 times the amount you would normally use in lime. You know, and they can't afford that. So what happens is the field's like basically laid fallow for 2-3 years, and it may be productive again, but they're going to have to refertilize it and use a lot of compost on it. And that field, they lost that field, but luckily we cleared three. Well, I helped clear two. You know, I cleared one. They mostly cleared another one. I finished it off and disked it for them. And then they cleared another one basically by hand, and they brought in they finally bought a tractor and they cleared another one. And, you know, then Courtney, for a lot of this time before they got the well and everything, she was living, she had a wall tent down in the woods. She had a dog with her, and you'd always worry about Courtney because we had a mountain lion running around. Luckily, she had a dog with her, but, you know, they don't know the risk that you could end up dead from one of these things, because they are what they are. I mean, a mountain lion is a mountain lion, and they're put out by the state to control the coyotes and the deer, and they don't tell us. They deny doing it, but it's in the state budget. You can find it, but when they kill your livestock, they're liable for it. So they say, oh no, it's an eastern mountain lion, which would be protected under the Endangered Species Act. No, it's a western mountain lion. Take the DNA and send it to UC Davis, because that's where they test it and they keep all the files on that sort of thing. And nuisance cats all are on file at UC Davis, University of California. Well, I know this. There's no way they could know this. And there's also some Canada lynx in the wood. Canada lynx in the woods there. I mean, off Church Avenue, that's where the mother had her den, which is about a mile south of that farm. You know, I'm a country boy, and you know, from up north, people talk to me about this sort of thing, and it's, you know, I know where to look to see them. You know, the mountain lion's den, the one that we had near, it was about a mile from me across the street in Claremont State Park. It's in a huge oak. It's about 5 foot across at the base, and there's a big hole in it, about 3 foot up. And you see the claw marks up in the tree where it goes up in the hole. I mean, this is a lion. This is a 100-pound cat. It can kill you. And people, you know, they don't understand the risks. But luckily, they've never had. But then Kaya and her father, mostly Kaya's father and Kaya, got the maple syrup operation going. That was 5-6 years now, and they've been improving on it every year. And then, I guess on a good year, they'll make 75 gallons of syrup, which at $65, $70 a gallon, when you figure how they're selling it by half pints, they're averaging about $70 a gallon. You know, for 3-4 weeks' work, that's a nice chunk of change in the spring. But, you know, Kaya's moved on to other things other than the farm. And it's, you know, you get to see the course of the cycle of things in a year. Nicholas and Eileen had been farming up in Vermont, and I don't know that much about before them. And they come, and they're competent. They really don't need me, and they have now have a history in the farm. So I sort of like, well, I know them, and I help out, and I've hired Nicholas for, you know, cleaning my barn when I had baby cattle because the shoveling got too much. And so I'd hire him for one day a week to clean out for the baby calves. And, you know, I'd bottle feed the calves and raise them. And it's, and from an agricultural point of view, they're far more knowledgeable about soils and plants and seedings and distances and, you know, side dressing potatoes and a lot of this stuff than any of the others have been. And they're good people. They're, I mean, and you look at the difference in personalities. I mean, you know, Kaya grew up very dirt poor, you know, in a very rich area. And, you know, the other kids would throw rocks at her. You know, she hates those people there. And she's like, I don't ever want to be like that. And she took that and she said, I want to create a better world. You know, and that's something you got to respect. She took something that would have been terrible and she turned it into something really good and put it into part of who she is and the drive that makes her go. Ashley, she likes farming. She just, you know, as Ashley's mother says, she cuts her own swath. She does things a lot of her own way. But Ashley can be kind of narrow at times. She's like, I only pay attention to what I have to pay attention to. Well, when you're trying to give them an agricultural exemption and save them $7,000 a year, it's hard for me to understand that that's not on her radar. You know, I'm trying to save you a boatload of money. Pay 5 minutes of attention. Well, no, I'm doing this today, and that's it. So sometimes she can be hard to work with. But if you're looking for someone who's task-oriented who will get a job done, Ashley's definitely the person you want. And Courtney, Courtney had such a tough exterior. You know, she was like, you know, if one of the guys, she would go over with a guy named Bob that I knew that ran the Northeast, the blacksmithing organization, and she would do blacksmithing as a hobby. And that's mostly a guy thing. One of the guys would comment on how she looked, she'd tear them apart. She wouldn't hesitate to walk over and just clock them, and she would hurt them. I mean, she worked, she's tough, but she's like, she wanted to be known for what she does in a day, not how she looked. But the thing about Courtney, and, you know, as a personality, her father died when she was young. She was about 11. And she ended up in a boarding school. And she didn't go home on vacation very much. And Ashley and Kaya would take her home. You know, and they were a year or two older, but they would take her home rather than leave her in a boarding school. And Courtney's biggest fear was abandonment. She didn't want to form attachments to people because she felt that everybody would abandon her or leave her. So she was very, wanted to be very, how do you say, independent. And my wife and I just fell in love with her. I mean, she just, you know, you understand the kind of pain and you understand the work ethic and that she wants something better. And that it's like I saw Courtney, she came down to see Bob because Bob ended up like sort of a father figure to her. Bob died this past year, so I probably won't see Courtney again, but she came down to the county fair. And my wife sees Courtney and just runs over and gives her a big hug, you know, and it's just sweet. And we talked about it, and we sell soap at the county fair from Vermont Soap. It's organic vegetarian soap, coconut palm and olive oil. It's a really high-quality product, and it's something you're not going to find generally in grocery stores. It's a real high-quality product. We had some really nice big cakes of soap, and we went over, you know, we just gave it to her there, and she comes over to the booth, and Jerry had gone home, and she wants to get nasty with me. And she says, "What do you think, I'm dirty?" And I was like, "No, that's not it." And she's all defensive, and she's getting all, you know, like trying to be tough and nasty. And I said, "Courtney, what it comes down to is you're up in Essex County, and you're up there alone without friends, and you're starting something new, and you want a farm in your life, and you're building something. And when you get home at the end of a day, you're hot, you're tired, you're sweaty, and you want to get cleaned up. Go in and take a shower, and you'll have a bar of nice-smelling soap. And have that scent remind you that somewhere out there, there are people who remember you, think of you well, and wish you well." Well, she started to cry. And, I mean, she's never cried. She's like, she would never, ever cry. But she just stood there crying. And she's trying to hide it. So I gave her a hug, and I haven't seen her since. It's been about 3 years, 2 years now. Now I have seen her once since. For a couple minutes. But it's like she can't believe that people will remember her and think of her that well, you know, because she doesn't want to form those attachments because she's afraid of being rejected or lost. So she's very much standoffish. At least that's the way I see them. But when you look at what they do in the community, like we had a woman who was had muscular dystrophy, and her daughter was, what do you call it, Tourette's syndrome, very badly and partially retarded. And they needed to move from Red Hook over to Woodstock, to where the school had a program that could work with the kid, because they didn't have one over here. And they had a mountain of stuff. Well, the guys at the lodge, they came up with the money for a truck. Well, I talked to the kids, and six of them came from the farm. Courtney was there, Ashley was there, Kaya, Ben and Lou, a couple others. There's probably six or seven of them. And in 6 hours, they loaded a 24-foot truck, floor to ceiling, end to end. And I mean floor to ceiling. There wasn't a square inch. And no matter what the kid was screaming about, they'd go on to the next thing and then come back to it. They just did it. And, you know, people knew we were going to help move, but you have all these neighbors around. When they saw us come to help move, all the neighbors just sort of disappeared and went in their houses. They all walked away because they didn't want to get involved. But because there was need, these kids would help and get involved. You know, that's an asset to the community. Well, in a small community, things like that get around. And when you have people like that that would help when no one else will, because you're dealing with mental illness, you're dealing with, I don't know if you've ever dealt with anybody with serious Tourette's, but they're a handful. And, you know it's a job that's got to be done. You know there's no money involved, and you know it's going to be thankless, and they do it anyway. You know, and they did this after spending 10, 12 hours working on the farm. They came and did this till midnight. They got the truck loaded. We got it over to Woodstock and unloaded. The furniture's in place. All the other stuff stacked chest high or eyeball high in the garage. And we get out of there. But you can't. There's a value to this in a community. It's the difference between an area and a community. And these people are the kind of people that you want to build a community. And they do that sort of thing.
How do you see, where the farm might go in the future. What do you think will happen?
Truth be told, I think they'd be better off keeping the house as a housing cooperative in a way, and if they can purchase the property as a housing cooperative and then use that farm as part of a larger farm with better fields and use that as an adjunct facility to a larger piece as they get better skilled and better. Give you an example. The farm Ashley's at now is 55 acres of some of the best land in the county. It can outproduce what they produce in Germantown tenfold, easily tenfold, and probably twofold per acre, all things being equal. It's much better property for this, and it has much easier access to irrigation, much flatter, easier to irrigate, everything accordingly. The farm in Germantown had been an orchard for a reason. It was easier to run it as an orchard because the slopes of the land, the access to water, the downhill side of the highway, the amount of rock in the soil, the amount of rock in the soil. I'm hoping it'll go on as part of something bigger, because the truth is, if you're Nicholas and Eileen, and understand, I don't know, but it's an educated guess that if they're eating, living there, and making $20,000-$25,000 a year in their pockets a year for the hard work they're doing and being there all year, it's not enough. You know, and you need to do things a little larger, a little more efficiently, you know, someplace with a little bit better soils. But that doesn't say that farm doesn't have a purpose. Because, for example, if you put in any given year, let's say you put 2 acres of garlic in there instead of less than an eighth of an acre, a few rows. But if you put in 3 acres of garlic, you can maximize what you do there. You can do it efficiently, and you can do it without the deer coming in destroying it, without other animals coming in. You can pick plants where you don't have the predation from the rabbits and the predation from the deer and all the other difficulties that come with raising 100 types of vegetables, because I guess they've cut down to 50 this year and did away with the CSA because it was just too much for two people to do. But if you do this in context with a larger group and can do that for specifically and keep the house as like almost like a housing cooperative, so that it'll make the money and pay a majority of the taxes, and that it can work. And they keep the barn as and set up a wood shop there for in the winter, and they keep the maple syrup going. But the nature of it is that hand camp competition, because the truth is, when I went to the New Farmers talk at the Germantown Library this week, you know, Ashley spoke there, and she's a new farmer, that she was one of the speakers. And she's quite, when somebody asked, "Well, what do you think the market saturation is?" And she says, "Well, I think we're up and being able to pick the low-hanging fruit." But the truth is, they know they can't compete with through trains from the Sacramento Valley and from Arizona coming into Rotterdam, supplying 80% of the produce here in the Northeast, when they're paying slave labor wages out west and most efficient method and full mechanization. They know they cannot compete economically with a rigged corporate environment that can sell less than your cost of seed and fertilization to do it with their method. But what they can do here is raise a better product, and that's what they do. They raise a much better product. The heirloom variety tomatoes, the heirloom variety vegetables, the heirloom variety, you know, while they don't certify themselves as organic, they basically are, but the certifications are difficult. And to sell in a store, they need to be able to certify and do the paperwork so that you can verify crop methodology and trace that crop all the way around. And that's easy enough to do if you're raising one thing. If you're raising 100, that means 100 times the paperwork. It's not practical. It's just not practical or possible. So I see them evolving because the truth is they need health care. And with the president's health care initiative, that may cost them some money because they're going to have to buy health care. They've been getting health care through the farm workers, basically the health care clinic that's set up for the migrant labor, paid for as for farm worker labor, and they've been getting health care through that, clinics. Well, that doesn't work for all that long. And yes, they can shop thrift stores and go to the carousel, and we get a lot of nice clothing off Fifth Avenue, and they know where to buy work clothes for $3 and $5. But you have to realize there comes a time, like Nicholas and Eileen, they want a house of their own. They want a family of their own. They have hopes and aspirations and dreams like anybody else. I'm sure, most of these girls want children at some point. And frankly, poverty sucks and they know it. And they're going to want something better. So I'm hoping the farm goes on, but I kind of think it has to change to some degree to fit a larger economic model. And the land's available in the area, the leasing the property, and the property values are dropping so that it might become possible for them to buy property. Our senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, when she was our congresswoman, for small farms, she got more through the farm bill in Congress, and most of it was stripped by the Senate when she was in Congress, but she got more into that farm bill, and she actually got more passed than small farmers that had in the farm bill since 1922. I mean, she did more than anybody else in a long, long time. And you got to look at it. 40 farms in this county. It's an economic revival. Let's say that farm makes $75,000 to $80,000 a year in gross receipts. And that doesn't include the maple syrup, probably. It doesn't include... Well, maybe it does include the maple syrup. I don't know. But when you look at that, when you figure they're spending $20,000 on costs and then have to divide them between the two or three people that are working, that's not a lot of money. But if you're not paying rent and you're not paying for food, there's no cable TV, the farm pays for the telephone, the only thing you pay for is your cell phone, and the house has wireless internet as part of your rent. So your only real bill, probably, I don't know what they do with electric, but your only real bill is your cell phone when you live there. That's your only real bill if you're working the farm. If you're not working the farm, you pay a rent, and you pay for food. So that if you're working the farm, yes, you have much less expenses and under their business model. And, yeah, but... there's a nice attitude that they have. Like, Nicholas's birthday was in March. And Nicholas's favorite play or show in the world is Jesus Christ Superstar. And it just came back to Broadway, $200 a ticket. They don't have $200 for a ticket. But Eileen wanted to do something for his birthday. So she got 40 of us together, and we sat over there for 3 weeks rehearsing it. And on Nicholas's birthday... His sister brought him to the farm, and two of the guys grabbed him, took him down to the barn, and dressed him as Jesus Christ, and we performed the play for them. And, that's a birthday he and everybody else is going to remember for a lifetime. But this is the kind of attitude they have to have in order to live like this, because they're finding ways to do things without money. But the truth is, at some point, they're going to want a family. They're going to want to raise a child. And they do want to have the kid have some advantages. They don't want, they want the same things everybody else does. But they're looking at a better way. They're trying to do something. And they're starting something up where there was nothing. These farms were abandoned. And getting the land for paying the taxes on it, you know, and improving the property.
Do you see how things have changed from the community in relation to the farm?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because now instead of, oh, what are those dirty hippies doing? Oh, they're dirty. They smell. Now you get, damn, you see how hard they work? You know, there's a big change in attitude there. Or, oh, I see they did this. Or, oh, they must have got hurt with a hailstorm. And see how they're replanting and see how they're working at this. Or, oh, yeah, they were working over at so-and-so's place. And they were working over because people notice and they talk. But now, you know, there's never been any scandal there in the community. Yes, they have parties there for 200-300 people. But they use the parking lot of the garage across the street. And the guy, he lets them. He thinks, hey, that's great. I'm not, you know, this is a nice way to do things. People are willing to work with them. The local grocery store buys their vegetables to sell. They're involved in things in the community. They're involved with things at Hawthorne Valley Farm. They're involved with plays here in town at Time and Space Limited. They're involved with plays up, you know, what's his name? He and his wife. The guy lived up here in Fifth Street. He died last week. He was the choreographer for the dance company of the Congo when they formed in 1960. And he just died this past week. But he's got 8, 9 kids. You know, and he came to America because when it came Zaire, he would have been killed. But, you know, they meet people like that and they help out with their plays and they do things like that in the community. And they add so much culturally to it. I mean, you know, I look at it and say that building was built in the 1850s to make cannonballs. And look at what they've done to it. All the stuff from less than 25 miles away. You can say, oh, it's utopian, but I got to say it works. And I got to say, look at the results. There's no government money involved in that. There's no grants. No, they just did it. And they worked at it. And, you know, the last mayor, like when Kaya went to him about helping about the radio station, you know, the mayor of the city took one look at her and said, anything you want, anything I can do. So like St. Mary's School over there, they're having people in for a fundraiser, and they got 300-400 people coming to town from all over from up in the city, had no place to put them. They put them up in the school. They used the old school kitchen to feed them. And, you know, Kaya wanted me to bring my cookers in to cook, and I was like, going to Hudson, do this. I said, I'll end up poisoning people. And telling me 2 weeks in advance, I don't have time to prepare. I could do this if I have a month to plan it out, figuring what the, you know, cost and everything else. But she could do it on the fly, and the mayor just supported her on it. But how many people can say that now when the local politicians will go, gee, and in Germantown, the attitudes changed when a number of them registered to vote. I don't know whether they registered in the Green Party or whether they socialist worker. I could care less, but they registered to vote. And in a local town, that means people pay attention. The local politicians, they pay attention. And then it's like one of them was there, Ben Schwartz. When Ben Schwartz, he was working on the farm the first couple of years, and I forgot about him. He's running the farm out in Harlem Valley now. And Ben got a heart of gold, the nicest guy in the world, but he'll break anything he touches. I mean, he's just a klutz in a lot of ways. And, you know, best one of the best guys you ever want to meet. And yet, he got a ticket because he thought he had valid insurance. Came out of a company in Georgia. P.S., he didn't have valid insurance. But which can cost you a license for 6 months. It can cost you a $2,500 fine. And can cost you, 6 months in jail. Well, he ended up with a $250 ticket for a broken taillight. Yeah, they charged them the maximum on a broken taillight. But all the other stuff, they threw out. And a cop sort of like said, you know, the judge feels this way about these people because they're working, they're not drugs. You know, I had Ben put on a, you know, understand. We went to the thrift store and it was $15. A suit, tie. I told him how to stand in front of the judge, don't put his hands on the bench, how to do this, talk to this lawyer over here. And the lawyer went up and he explained the whole thing to the public defender, and Ben stood there, and, yes sir, no sir, you know, and I'm throwing this out, $250 fine. He said, I can have you that by the first of the month. And you know, when you're looking at a strict liability situation that could put him in jail for 6 months, and the judge, local judge, says $250 fine, you know, you are getting some community respect, because they saw a farm that had been derelict, you know, druggies, shitheads, layabouts, you know, lack of a better term, ne'er-do-wells. Now they've got people there working, trying to clean it up. You know, it's never going to be a show place, but they're making it livable. They're putting a piece of property back so it's a usable asset in the community. It's not a blighted, falling down, you know, remnant of something that once was. They're making something new, and they're making something good. And people in town talk about that over time. And they'll ask me about it. Like, I'll be over at the Legion Post asking them. I said, well, what about these people? We see your tractor over there. We see you doing stuff over there. I said, well, you know, in a small town, all you need is somebody to speak up for you. And if somebody will speak up for you, that's half the battle. And if you can honestly speak up and say, well, look at what they do and why. Look at what they're doing. And, you know, you want to hunt the property? Go ask them. Bring a bottle of wine. They'll let you hunt the property. You know, they're not anti-local. They're not anti-this. But they're trying to do something a better way. And even the farmers, you know, the old school, old line farmers, they say, they have respect for them because they know what these kids are going through. They know what they've had to do to build it. They know what it is to have no money, no backing. Most of these farmers have been in business 100, 150 years. You know, fourth, fifth generation. And they know if their parents didn't give it to them, it wouldn't have happened. And they're running it, and they may make improvements on it, and they may employ people. But for some of them, without the family trust fund, that farm wouldn't be there because of the market, you know, the vagaries of the market, for lack of a better term. I mean, crops fail. Things fail. Does that make sense? So, that, you know, they're looked on relatively positively, but yet, you know, you have to understand they're also kind of, they don't, they have a circle of people that they travel in, and they're pretty much alike. They do reach out beyond the age group, which is rare, and they reach out to other cultures and other people who have come into the valley. But the old mainstream, they tend to stay away from. And, you know, it's a shame because these old mainstream people at this point would really want to help them. And it's, most of them would. I mean, they look at it in the first, oh, they're dirty, they're this and that. And you say, and when you say to them, yeah, that's because the well's silted up and they're trying to get the well done. They're trying to get money to redig the well. They're trying to get money to do this, and they're trying to get money to do that. And then you say, well, yeah, I saw them. They didn't smell so bad. Yeah, well, the well works. They can take showers. You know, before, they're having to wash down in the pond or walk half a mile down to the creek, you know, to wash. You know, it's like, hey, guess what? Hygiene becomes, you know, and you're working in 90, 100-degree heat, and, you know, to wash, it's half a mile walk one way, half a mile walk back, through the woods with the bugs and everything else. You know, people don't understand how hard this is.
Do you think that how were you welcomed when you came to this area? Do you think that's influenced you?
I knew some people because I knew other people who'd worked in corrections. And I knew some people, some farmers, because I had to buy hay. But people saw me putting in fence lines by hand. I didn't bring in machinery. I dug my fence post by hand. And this is when I was feeling better and could do it. I put up my fences by hand. They'd see me buying hay. And I'd meet people. And the difference for me is, like, I joined a local Masonic lodge. And I don't know if you know anything about that, but what it is basically a morality club. I mean, the idea is you can make good men better, but you can't make a good man. But what it does is mostly we're a charitable group. And we try to do, like, the lodge I joined, I'm no longer a member there, but the lodge I joined when the hospital north in Rhinebeck needed an expansion. They wanted $10 million for expansion. Three members of that lodge and the rest of them from the hospital foundation went around to the community and were able to raise $10 million to put that expansion on with no mortgage. The people of that caliber. And it isn't that they had the money themselves, but they're people that are not politicians, but people who have been in the community a long time, and they're that well respected. Well, I ended up joining Monumental Lodge in Tivoli because we take care of the small things, the cemeteries, the old elderly people. You know, we do a fundraiser for the football league or that was trying to start up. We do a fundraiser for the ambulance corps. We do a fundraiser. We just did one for the Bicentennial Committee. We, you know, they come to us because they know we're not going to say no, and they know we're going to give them, and we have supporters. So it's funny, but like I just cooked a luncheon on the 4th of July for the Southern Tier seniors down at Palatine Park, and they made me a senior citizen. They entered me on the rolls because I cooked for them. But they asked me to do it for them because they'd been having cold cuts at their summer picnic. And I said, yeah, cold cuts on a 90-degree day isn't going to work. But the best barbecue chicken most of them have ever eaten goes over very well. So I go and cook that and some, you know, slow-roasted sausage and peppers and, you know, hot dogs. And, you know, they love it. But I do that for them because they're the ones that support me on all the charity dinners for the last 15, 20 years. Because I learned to barbecue as a kid. You know, and don't laugh, but for odd reasons, I ended up in the hills of North Carolina with old black men. You know, and these guys were in their 70s and 80s. And I'd sit up there while people were out signing up voters, and I'd learn to barbecue with these old guys. So the guys come back and they'd eat chicken necks and chicken backs. And, you know, we would get hogs' heads and hogs' feet and, you know, the things that would be waste products from the slaughterhouse that we could buy for 3 cents a pound. Because that's all these people could afford. But we learned to turn that into gourmet food. And you learned how to slow cook it. And it turned it into something so good that people just like, this is amazing. So now you go to some of these places, they're making barbecue beef out of prime rib. Well, it's actually choice. It's rib roast. But it's, you know, choice or select. You know, try making that out of a tough cut of meat instead of the best cut of meat. And I mean, they don't understand what barbecue is. Barbecue is stuff for poor people. It was stuff that you made something good out of something. And those are the kind of people, you know, I knew as a kid. And, you know, they were good people. You know, they weren't educated. You know, there was like, they didn't have much, but they'd give you all they had. And I mean, you have to understand that there's something to that. And when you see these kids in Germantown, they reminded me of that in some ways. And you know, their idea of maybe something better. You know, I see religious people doing this, or you know, politically indoctrinated people doing this. This isn't the case. They have their political views, but that's not what drives them. They drive them because they think they can make a better world by doing. And I think they're right, because that's the only way things ever really change, is by people doing and other people saying, gee, that's a good way. And, you know, 40 farms in 10, 12 years now makes a difference. It'll change this community. Look at what's happened here in Hudson. Look at how that's changed. And does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I want to thank you very much. We could go on, but that's yeah. A really nice, really great interview. I know you've got things to do, so I just want to thank you. Is there anything else I haven't asked you about, or anything else you'd want to?
You know, I babbled on quite a bit, so I'm not really sure what I said at this point.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.